I wanted to mention, and some people have said, if they buy this tape set that we have called A Guide to Effective Rescue Mission Recovery Programs, if they'll get the same stuff that they're getting at this session. Well, actually, I promised people I'm doing new stuff. So I'll be touching on some of this in some ways, but I'm hoping that this was done 4 years ago, and I've learned a few things in the last 4 years watching rescue mission workers go at it. So I'm hoping there'll be some new things here, especially for those of you who've actually used the tape set. It's available for $50, and you know, we've sold nearly 1,000 of these, which has been amazing to me, and I'm hearing a lot of good stories. It's been a blessing. People have been able to use it. Now, we have a interesting topic here, as you can tell. Is it easy to change at your mission? Now, I really struggled with the title. But maybe the easiest, another way of saying this is your mission a place where it's easy to change your life? Or is the environment of your facility such that when people come in and they want to change their lives, that we don't have obstacles in the way that keep them from actually experiencing the change that they want? Does that make sense? When you send out your newsletters, we talk a lot about how we're feeding people and sheltering people at the mission. And sometimes this rehabilitation thing has been a little harder sell. But we're seeing a change in how people are looking at us. And a change also in the way donors perceive any type of Christian organization. Before generation of people who maybe are 50 and older today have a different attitude toward institutions. And oftentimes what they look at is the leader. And they have a great trust in the leader. And if the leader is someone that they have confidence in, they tend to be willing and more able to give to that organization. And so for years in the world of fundraising, we've really tried to say that the director is the face of the mission. And that get his image out, get his personality out there, build that trust and relationship with the donor between the director and the mission, and that's how you raise funds. And right now we're at the phase where we have the 50 and older donors are still a major part of our funding base. But if you begin looking at the people who are in their 40s and younger, they're becoming a little different. They're not so much looking at who's in charge or who's running the place as what are the results. And you know, tomorrow we'll be talking a lot about this whole concept of evaluation, what does success look like, how do we know if we're successful, how do we tell of our successes as such. And in so a lot of ways, a lot of the donors who are coming up are saying, well, how is what you do unique? And what is the result of what you're doing? And, ultimately, people have been throwing millions of dollars at the homeless issue. And yet, it's not going away. I suppose there's a little paradox in that, because Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. Which means that in our lifetime, we're not going to see poverty eradicated. The poor will always be with us, just like Jesus said. But does that mean that because they'll always be with us, we should stop caring for them and reaching out to them? Definitely not. So through the IEGM, we're working to look at more things regarding success and people leaving our facilities and moving out and leading successful, stable lives. And we've had a task force on it. We'll be starting to do some data gathering. We've developed a questionnaire that you'll probably all see eventually on success. But the biggest thing that I think we need to understand is that there's things that we call outcomes and there's things that we call outputs. And for years at the mission, it seems like we've done a lot of our fundraising based on outputs. we reported our outputs. We've served so many meals. We gave away so many, so much clothing. We've provided these services. But now it's time to say what's coming out of this. And I believe honestly that what should be coming out of this, or the ultimate product of our energies and our effort, is changed lives. And as I said in the last session, one of the biggest reasons people burn out in rescue mission work is because they don't see results. And it doesn't really matter how many meals you've put out or how many beds you've provided. It's, are people coming in as wounded, hurting, dysfunctional folks, and are they leaving as wounded, healing, dysfunctional folks who are on the road to change? Now, you notice how I said that there. I've oftentimes told people that the most we can hope for is to send them off as struggling baby Christians. And yet if we've done that much, and especially struggling baby Christians who know how to get the help when they need it and where to get it from, we've done a radical thing that is a massive, wonderful outcome. And that's kind of what we'll talk about, especially in the next session, is preparing people for life out there. There's a little term I like to use called missionizing. And what a missionizing is, our brand of institutionalization. That is, we teach people to function in the mission and not in the in real life, more or less. And one of the interesting things that we're seeing is, as I'm talking with more mission workers and recovery programs, is that there's a whole subculture of people out there who are shifting through our missions, who have learned how to function in the mission setting. If they come in and they know how to say what needs to be said and how to fit into the program and do their work so well and are so quiet and cooperative, but are not responding at all to our message. And so my hope through all of this is that we can even reach out to those who have been missionized so that they won't stay comfortable in that condition, and that we won't create any more people that are missionized. But in a sense, I believe honestly, and I'll be talking about this more, that we should be working ourselves out of a job. It's not like there's not more homeless people that haven't had help, so that we can't let go of the other ones that we've worked with, if you know what I'm saying. If we really worked ourselves out of a job in the life of everybody that God sends our way, we're not going to run out of people to help. And some people, because of their own codependency issues, have this need to be needed, and we'll talk about that too. So here's the big question of the hour, okay? Is it easy to change? One of our speakers that we've had, named Jeff Van Vonderen, had a tremendous insight that I've carried with me for many years. And he said, Jesus said I must be about my Father's business. And he said he believes that what Jesus was saying about that is, I need to spend my time on people who want to hear what I have to say. And that I can't, there's a whole world of people out here and a whole world of needs out there. And so I can't be everything to everybody and meet every need of everybody that comes my way. So I have to be discerning with my time and make sure that it's spent with the people who will be most responsive to what I have to share. And we just alluded to that earlier when I said that sometimes, you ever notice it's the troublemakers who take more of your time than the sincere people. The squeaky wheel gets the grease, etc. Well, I believe it's actually a strategy of the devil in your mission to keep you so consumed and caught up in the people that he knows aren't ready that you're burnt out and tired and have no time for the people who really will respond to what you have to say. And that's where we talked about in the last session about this whole concept of the healing community becoming a reality in your facility, that it becomes self-monitoring, that people begin to have ownership, that people are committed to their own recovery and realize that this program is a format to experience that healing and change in their lives. It's a very complicated issue sometimes, but I believe that if we can remove some of the hindrances to change that are in our programs, we'll see a lot more success. And to be honest with you, I guess the opposite is what causes more problems, I think, than anything else, is not a very well-organized program. Too many missions are just too formal or too informal. They haven't thought through the processes. They haven't got schedules nailed down, curriculums nailed down. They haven't got the format that's necessary to see a program happen. And there are a couple of things that I want to mention to you that I think are essentials to see this happen. And we talked about it last time, that it's very important that your program, whether it's a women's program or a men's program, deals with some addiction-specific topics along with the spiritual development stuff. Addiction is a kind of issue that has to be hit on head-on. It can't be dealt with from the side. And you all have speakers and counselors, and you probably have an office of the national, some of the National Coalition for Against, or I can't remember, the National Association for Alcoholism and Codependency, and there are several things that you get, films and videos, and there's an excellent curriculum called the Staying Sober Education Modules by Terence Gorski. There are things like that. There are also, I think, some things that are screening tools. We have simple things like the Michigan Alcohol Screening Tool in the recovery guide, so that you do addiction assessment more than just saying, do you have a drug problem? To ask people about their use and to find out where they're at with the addiction issue. Because if that's there in their lives and it's never addressed head on, they're not going to stay sober, and anything you do after that will count for naught. You've invested somewhat in their lives, but as I said last time, we're not in the business of creating more biblically literate drunks. We want people who are sober. And another thing that I think is really important is that we need to have well-defined phases through which our participants progress. And that means that we want to have recovery-oriented goals and objectives for them that are in writing. And that rather than using, like I said, we talked about throwing out the calendar last session, rather than saying, you've been around here, you're here for 3 months, that's phase one, the next phase is 3 months, we need to think about setting up objectives that would be part of that process. Because people need that sense of movement. If you just hanging around at the mission is not going to satisfy most people. They want to know that there's movement, that there's progress, that something's really going on in their lives. Probably the simplest way you could do this is to take one phase of your program that would be steps 1 through 5, and that would be getting people through that fourth and fifth step process that we talked about last time. A second phase that would be culminated in steps 8 and 9, as we'll talk about next session, which is becoming reconciled and making amends with people in your life. And then steps 10 through 12 would be the third phase. And that would be, and you could have specific things, and it's more outlined in this recovery guide again, how you have that. But what you do is, and then for those, you might have somewhere along the line, you don't go to step 3 until you've quit smoking. Or you don't go to step 3 until you've completed your GED. But what I'm saying is, setting up specific things that people must complete or do before they move to the next phase. So that realistic expectations, and people know what's coming, what they need to do to move forward. And then also for those, that movement for the phase, I think we need to have it set up in a way so that people know whether they're progressing or not. And so you have this written plan, and they actually, you can have a checklist or something like that, so they know when things are completed. And then what you need to do is is have a party for each phase they move through. Missions give chips, they give certificates, etc. But that somehow there is an affirmation, like I said, a celebration. And in one of my recent articles in the Rescue Magazine, I talked about that the joy that the father of the prodigal son had when his son returned from the pig's pen. Remember that story? He killed the fatted calf, put a ring on his finger, put a new robe on him. Well, I think sometimes one of our problems in rescue missions is that we have a tendency to set up expectations for people, but it's kind of like the expectation is the final product rather than the stages of growth, if you know what I'm saying. It's like not building into our process ways to recognize people and celebrate their achievements, though they might, in our mind, different steps. Because my feeling about this, and I talked about it earlier again, and that is who we're working with at the mission, we're working with wounded people. And one of the things that is characteristic for every wounded person is that they have not had affirmation in their lives. They have tended not to have people who pat them on the back and cheer them on and affirm them in making most of the positive reinforcement, if you call it that they've received in their life has tended to be to do the bad things and the wrong things. So hopefully there's a payoff for a job well done, for effort expended, for something that has been accomplished. And you know, because your situations are different, your resources are different, your programs are different, I don't know if I can be truly specific about what way you can do that, but you got to make a big deal out of it. That's what I was saying. A few weeks ago, or a few months ago, I was at the Kansas City Rescue Mission, and because I'm here at the IEGM office, I volunteered at the local missions to keep my hand in what's going on, because I don't ever want to lose track of the people that we're reaching. And so I got to be part of one of their weekly chapels, and they do it once a month where they give out chips and certificates for people that have moved forward. So, for instance, through Alcoholics Victorious, we know we have sell these little plastic chips. They're only a quarter, and they're to recognize your first month of sobriety, your first 3 weeks of sobriety, your first 3 months, your first 6 months. And of course, in AA they do the same thing, months and weeks, and I mean months and years. And it might seem like a minuscule, silly thing, but you could see in the demeanor of each person who received that, and the applause from the other men in that program, that was such an affirming and significant thing to get my 1 month chip. And you might say, well, you're supposed to stay sober. Why should we pat you on the back for doing something you're supposed to do? But if I've been an active addict for 10 or 12 years, if I've got a month of sobriety, something dramatic has happened in my life, and we should celebrate it. The same with the 6 months, the year anniversaries, passing through phases. They gave out little computer-generated parchment certificates. And you go to the rooms of the men, those things are displayed as if they were a PhD from Harvard. Because for them, it's so meaningful. And if we don't do that, we've missed a tremendous opportunity to build people up in the Lord and let them know we care and we recognize. See, they need that affirmation because they have not gotten it. So these are simple things. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the staff responsibilities, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the staff hang-ups. I'll be positive first. And this is, as you can see, I'm keying off of sort of what I've just told you. One of your, you know, if there's a healing environment that's going to become part of your mission, whose job is it to make sure that it stays a healing environment? The staff people. It's your job to monitor the spiritual, emotional climate of your mission. And that's kind of maybe a new concept to you. But pray that God, by His Spirit, would give you a discerning heart to see if things are getting wild or lax or heavy. You know what I'm saying? Some of those things that you may not be able to put your finger on, but you know something about that climate is changed. And as you begin to think in this way, I think you'll begin to pick it up more. And especially if you can move toward developing a program that is well-organized and self-maintaining, you can tell when that environment is there, and you can tell when people are just doing their own thing. It'll be very marked difference. And so then you're monitoring this healing environment, and it's really important, I think, when you think of your client or the person that you're working with, that you want to help them establish these benchmarks for growth. And that's why you don't just sit down and say, you need this, 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 and this, but you let them have a chance to tell you what they want to accomplish. And you're not a big authority as much as coming alongside as a mentor, a guide, a coach. That's a whole different kind of a way of thinking. But I would think that the best, most productive way you can serve as a Rescue Mission chaplain or counselor is to be a personal growth coach for each of the people in your facility or program. And it sort of takes the pressure off it because you don't feel quite so responsible because they can only receive as much from you as they want anyway. You can't force them to do anything. But you can keep holding out to them these things. So that's why I really believe that one of the very first things, one of the very first questions you'd ever ask somebody who comes into your program is, number one, why are you here? And number two, what do you want to accomplish while you're with us? And of course, if they have some ownership or they've helped to create these goals and objectives for themselves, that will cause them to be much more committed to the plan that finally comes out. I think it's very interesting. And I think you might find that people will say things very differently than you thought. Not just, I want to get a job or I want to get a house, but I'd like to make things right with my ex-wife while I'm here, you know? I'd like to grow closer to God. I'd like to get some sobriety under my belt, those kind of things. Another thing is to help them develop new personal and social resources which contribute to a positive lifestyle. As we mentioned earlier, the truth of the matter is, when we talked about this concept of disaffiliation, which means people who become homeless because they lack meaningful human relationships and they lack a personal support system, our job is to help them develop a support system. Help them to know what resources they have within themselves for a healthy, positive life, and also help them to know what resources are out there in our community, our city, that are available to them after the program and while in the program that they can access, and helping them to do that. You see, too often times people come to us with a notion that they want us to fix them. You ever see that or experience that? It's kind of like, well, I'm here, fix me. But the reality of this all is that if there's any changes in your life, you're the responsible party. And I've talked with people who argue a lot about this idea of the disease of addiction. And part of the issue they say is, well, if you buy that thing, then you're taking away personal responsibility. Well, it actually works just the opposite. If I know what I've got, then I'm 10 times more responsible about doing the right thing with it. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't abdicate, it actually puts it back on my shoulders. And a big part of, you know, having people work through denial is helping them to know for a fact that if there's changes, they will be done by them, not for them. And that's why even this title of the book, Power to Choose, basically the author says that one of the gifts of sobriety is that you get your own self-will back. In other words, all of a sudden you're back in control of your life. Of course, under God, in submission to Him. But if I'm in the throes of addiction, I'm out of control. It also, again, is to help them to access the needed resources. So it's not just saying, here's what will help you and what you need, the school, the GED testing, the medical, etc. But here's how you will do it. Because we always want to be working ourselves out of a job. I really believe that we have succeeded when we're no longer needed. So how do I do that? How does it happen? Well, it only happens when these people can do these things for themselves. And that's why the whole issue of that Dr. Ketterman talked about last night, of a reparenting. The truth is, in our healing environment that we want to create here, it's really, for many people, their first taste of family. It really is. And a lot of the dynamics of guidance, of approval, of affirmation, of learning personal responsibility, good work habits, dealing with attitudes, developing good values, all these things that should have happened in that family of origin but never did, ought to be happening in this program of ours, this healing environment we're talking about here. In a sense, the reparenting process happens, that we can create in our facilities a, you might say, replacement for the family they never had. And all the things they should have learned then will be learned while with us. I don't know about you, but when I really think about that, that's a tremendous responsibility. But it's also very powerful. And the first rule of maturity, right, is when people stop doing things for me that I can do for myself. Okay, so if those are some of the things that we can do for staff, we need to take a look at this whole thing of codependency. I'm afraid I may have skipped over some stuff here. Yeah, there it is. I got my slides out of sequence here. There's a couple other things for staff I wanted to mention. The other thing is determine what your clients' needs are. And that's why I believe everybody who comes to us is different. You believe that? I mean, we could say they're homeless as a class or a group of people. But when you talk about where they came from, what their needs are, where they might be headed, what's needed to develop the potential that they need, it's going to be different. And that's why we've a whole bunch of different forms in this recovery guide, and there's other assessment tools that we can use, like vocational testing, educational testing, GED testing, all these things. Because I think there's a process that needs to happen where we don't assume what people need, but spend the time with them and use the tools that are available to find out what their needs really are. And if somebody has got a court date coming up, they need to get there. But if we never take time to find out if they've got any legal problems, we'll never know about the court date. In the same sense, oftentimes they will tell us if we ask them, but we don't want to assume. And somebody talked about, well, you know, how big of a staff do you need, or a client-staff ratio? And my rule of thumb really is that if Jesus, the Son of God, couldn't significantly invest in more than 12 people at a time, meaning his disciples, I don't think we can have a client-staff ratio any smaller than that, if you know what I'm saying. That if you can't spend an hour or even 2 hours of good solid time with each person in your program, then you're seriously, seriously understaffed. Everybody has to have at least one or two full hours of face-to-face staff time, I think, to see changes happen in their life that are permanent. That 1 hour a week, yeah, or two. I'm saying just them and a staff person. And the best way to do that is to submit them, or set them up with one primary counselor, and that would be their responsible staff person that they would answer to and guide them through the program and be their advocate and mentor in that time. And that's why I see part of this thing is you can know what the person's needs are, but it's important for them to know what their needs are too. And that's even with the idea of denial and punching through that need for sobriety. And then also, finally, to know what resources are in your community that the person can use well with you, and also well when they're gone. So you know about the mental health people and the people who provide medical care to the homeless, but there may be other job sources. And I think every chaplain or counselor ought to have a notebook with phone numbers, contact person, something indexed for the community resources. Okay, let's go back here. Actually, these are some issues, and over lunch we talked about what are some of the issues that happen or problems when we move people from this client base into staff positions. Missions are very historically dependent on graduates of their programs to serve as staff members, and some of you are just that kind of person. And I really believe honestly that if you rely 100% on program graduates to run your program, you just might end up with a very dysfunctional program. And that you're much better off having a good mix of 50-50 or even two-thirds outside people and one-third former program people. Because it's so easy for your system to get ingrown. And just like a dysfunctional family, you can actually keep repeating some of the same dysfunctions within your staff. And it's so important to have outside people coming in, even if it means hiring a program graduate from another mission. They bring with them a whole new set of things that could be so very helpful. And so, in a sense, these are things that I see as problems, more like things that I see in staff people's lives that actually make it harder for people in the program to change. If that makes sense. And sadly enough, the tendency for folks coming through your program and into staff positions, they're more likely to have these issues. And I've always felt very strongly that a rule of thumb ought to be that you don't come on the payroll until you've had a year of sobriety. You don't have any authority here over anybody unless you've got at least a minimum of 1 year of sobriety. And in some cases, for program graduates, I would also maybe say until you've lived away from the mission for at least a year, that you've had a chance to taste real life for a while before coming in and trying to help work with other people. And some of the things that I just see is so common is that people who have been in the program and become staff members have a really hard time detaching because their whole life has been the mission. They may live there. They may have lived there, eaten there, slept there, maintained the most important friendships of their life there, and all of a sudden, they don't know any other life. And so, how do these folks then teach people about life on the outside if they haven't ever had a chance to enjoy it themselves? And actually, what happens when you don't detach? Detachment, actually, I believe that every Christian worker, just like every social worker, needs to understand something called professional distance. Have you ever heard that term? Professional distance? That means that between you and the person that you're working with is a gulf that helps me to know that I'm very different than you are. That I am here as a friend, advisor, counselor, mentor, coach, guide, but there's still a difference between us. In the case, there is authority if I'm a staff member, but more than that, I'm going to be able to leave you and your worries and your problems and your issues at the mission when I go home at night. And that I'm not going to be consumed with your problems and what's going on in your life and worried about what you're thinking, doing, or feeling when I have another world that I'm a part of. And that's why, you know, I so strongly believe that mission workers ought to have their own church, that the mission doesn't become their church, and that they really have a life outside of the mission. Because some really bad things can happen when you have no other life but the mission. And part of that is you get way too plugged into people, and you begin acting weird. And pretty soon, you are so caught up in their problems and their issues of their life that you can't make head or tail of what's going on in their lives or yours anymore. And after a while, being accepted by them and liked by them is more important than confronting them about the things that need to change in their lives. You see, our job is not to make friends with the people in our program. And that's what professional distance is about. You know, I can leave them at the mission and have another life of my own out here. And that's why, again, so many people struggle with dismissing people when they've used. Because they've become so plugged into them that they need the client as much as the client needs them. And that gets real messy. And that's where this caretaking and enabling comes in again. Because when you're overly plugged into people, and it's so easy when you've come up through the program and are now on staff, you don't have other friends. You don't have other relationships oftentimes. And so you feel really responsible then for these folks at the mission. Too responsible. Super responsible sometimes. And God, I think, would like us to be very careful in understanding that we're only a part of what He's doing in their life. We're not the whole package. And probably the mission is not the whole package either. But He's been working on them before they ever showed up at your doors. And whether you're there or not, He's still working in their lives. We have the privilege of working with them for a while. But hopefully it's a small part of their lives, because we're working ourselves out of the job with them. And this couple of enabling, of course, is this people-pleasing thing. Control freaks are in touch with their own feelings and emotions. That so easily happens when we get codependent. Then that results in dishonesty, failure to have our own intimate relationships and friendships, easy to become justifying and spiritualizing our own hang-ups and problems, and ultimately you see burnout and even physical problems in people's lives because they're too plugged in. And there's got to be ways outside of your ministry where you have another life. And hopefully you have a church that you can participate in a choir or teach a Sunday school class or something that's not just the mission. And we need to watch this also with people that have been in the program and are now on the staff. As I said before, we succeed when we're no longer needed. Let that be your motto. And if someone leaves your mission and never talks to you again the rest of their lives, you know, maybe you shouldn't feel too bad about it. Maybe you succeeded with them. And I know we found this out in our program in Michigan, that there were many people who did really well, and we never heard from them again. And you kind of almost feel hurt that, hey, I invested so much in them, and now they don't. Now good things are happening in their lives, and I can't share it because all I ever did was fight with them when they were in denial. That's as much of a part of their life I ever knew. But the other part of it is, so what? Maybe in heaven we'll know. But it's so much better that they, you know. A lot of times, what happens is when the time at the mission has been probably the worst time in their lives. And it was the bottom of their lives. It was the crisis. It was the pits. And somehow, it's sad, but we are kind of like associated with that time in their lives sometimes. And although we might have been part of them being restored and experiencing a new life, yet we may not be part of that so much anymore. And we have to accept that. So the most important thing we can do is to model a healthy and godly lifestyle, to be an example in word and deed of the principles you hope the client will adopt. In other words, somebody once said, you can't bring people any farther than you've come yourself. And Jesus said that when a disciple is fully mature, you know, he'll be like his master. In the same sense, you know, what we're doing is discipling. Actually, Christian counseling, in my opinion, is intensive discipling. Because it's not just dealing with the Bible, but also lifestyle and developing a godly lifestyle. And so we need to be that model. And so that's why it's really important for us to, when I talked about these codependency issues that can become so much a part of the rescue mission worker's life. And if you grew up in an alcoholic family, had an alcoholic spouse or parent, if you had an addiction yourself, I think if you want to be an effective rescue mission worker, you probably ought to be involved in a support group yourself. I really believe that. If you haven't dealt with your issues in those areas of your life, you're not going to be able to give the stuff people need, because you're still in denial about your own stuff.
And it's the ex-addicts, the staff members,
yes. Well, I think it depends on if you've had issues in your life or not. And, you know, because our goal is to help these people to learn to walk with the Lord on their own, and that means listening to their conscience and understanding personal prayer, Bible study, etc. But also, we're not trying to impart information, we're trying to impart a lifestyle, right? So we want that lifestyle to be modeled by ourselves. There's a couple of things that I think would be environmental factors that may be worth looking at and seeing if they're being practiced at your mission. One of the things that I like to talk about is real listening. You know, one of the things that doesn't happen on the street is people aren't listened to. When you become homeless, you know, you lose your identity. You lose your personhood, and there's no one to talk to. The homeless addict has got to be the most lonely person on earth. And, you know, every one of them has so many thoughts and feelings and needs and experiences and stories to tell. I believe, honestly, that we have to be committed to real listening. To making time, as I said before, for those one-on-one sessions, for group experiences, because I believe that there is a therapeutic value in talk. There's a lot of stuff that people have carried around for years that can be lifted from their shoulders if they just have a chance to talk about it. And that means not, you know, it's hard for us because oftentimes when people talk, we feel like we need to give advice. We need, you know, this same thing with husbands and their wives, you know. Wives know that there's a therapeutic value to talk. They won't necessarily look to us for answers or advice, but they sure look for an opportunity to process things with us and share things and get them off their hearts. Well, I think all people in our programs need these kind of opportunities. Another thing is respect. And I can tell you, I have been absolutely appalled sometimes that I've gone to missions where people forget that the people who we work with are really precious in God's sight. And that no matter what mess their life has become, that they still are precious in God's sight. And that there's a matter of dignity that's accorded to them despite what they've done, what they look like, what they smell like, where they've been. And, you know, again, on the street, that's not there. And see, part of these environmental factors I'm talking about is what I referred to in this last session of drawing the line in the sand, right? Drawing the line at the front door of the mission. This is the street, this is the kingdom. Well, real listening, respect, and some of these other things, this stuff is kingdom stuff. These are the things that are practiced in God's kingdom and are not found on the street. These are the things that will bring real healing to people. This individualized attention I talked about, which can be affirmed by time spent with them. And I believe honestly that there's a definite equation of staff investment equals that greater success. The more staff contribution to every activity has therapeutic value. That there's a sense that we're not just doing this because we need someone to wash the dishes around here. But that really there's a purpose for this. That we're through this, we want to give you an opportunity to learn responsibility and godly work habits. Through this, we're giving you an opportunity to serve your brothers here at the mission. Through this, you're helping us to be a good steward of what God has given us in these plates and pots and pans, and taking care of these things that are here because of the generosity of our donors. That if you look at all of it, at your program and how it functions, take a step back and see how each of these things can be an investment in people's emotional and spiritual and psychological health. Okay. So, we have about 15 minutes again, so if you have some more questions or anything I said. Yes.
I had an experience this past week at my shelter that at first I got kind of activated, but I didn't say anything because I had a whole school there with about 10 or 12 kids in the shelter. But I have one girl that she just gets really mad when we bring someone in to visit the shelter. She said that is infringing on our privacy.
Uh-huh.
And they get really upset about this because they don't want, and they're not abuse cases where they wouldn't want someone to know they're there. But they really dislike this, and that's part of our letting people know what we're doing. So how do you handle that?
So what you said, your issue is that how do you prepare clients or residents for mission tours?
I do prepare them as far as telling them we're going to have one and then making sure they get their rooms clean and this thing like this. But they just don't want them to see them there.
Where's the anger about cleaning the rooms?
Yeah, there could be multiple issues there. Is there an area where they can go where they wouldn't be seen?
Yeah, they can go outside. So I did suggest to her after everything was gone that and she is a girl that don't think she would be intimidated by anything. I said, since you are intimidated by people like this, I suggest that you not be in the room when they come in. Now, did I handle that correctly?
Yeah, and who knows? I think there may be, like David said, suggested, a whole multitude of issues there. You know, it could be the whole issue of personal property. I mean, she's a displaced person. She doesn't have a place to call her own, and she's trying to find that, you know. And so that it could, I mean, there could be a big issue in that. So that's...
Well, if that is the case, do I tell her that this isn't your permanent home, that you're working for a better place?
Oh, yes, definitely.
That's how I would handle that.
That's one way to do it. I think you need to let people know up front that part of it is that this roof is over your head because people have given money to fund the thing, and that we have a responsibility to show them where the money is going. I mean, it's part, and I think we haven't always done a good job of helping people to connect what they have in food and furniture and a roof over their head with generosity of strangers who are giving, who are providing these things because they care. I mean, there are many people who are so resentful, the church, this, and yeah, you know, Christians are nasty, bad people, and they, we haven't always let them know that, listen, there are good Christians that care about you and what's going on, and that this place, the fact that it's here, is an expression of the love of God's people for you.
Well, she spoke up and told them that, that with them there, I was really embarrassed, you know, that she did this. But then when we got in the hall, I asked them, I hope they did not take offense to it. And they said, and so they sent word back to her when they got ready to leave, would you please tell that young lady that we are sorry if we didn't bring them to her.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues there. Yeah.
You were talking about establishing well-defined phases.
Yes.
For a program with goals and objectives.
Uh-huh.
Should those be individualized, or should they be...
Okay, yes. Setting up, I think goals and objectives have, and phases for programs, have two parts. One is that you set up the general ones. And I talked about general ones, like we'll have done, completed step 5, we'll have done this certain set of Bible studies, we'll have shown a good attitude in work projects. So you'd have those general things there for that first phase. But within that first phase, there may be individual things as well, like we'll have, you know, called my mother to let her know that I'm here. We'll have called my probation officer to let him know that I'm here. You know what I'm saying? So that you would have it kind of on two levels. You'd have your general things that all people are to do, but then within that, you'd have some more specific things. Yes?
Can you talk about control freaks?
Control freaks? Okay, what about them? I don't like them. Okay, my definition of a control freak is a person who can't be at peace unless things are exactly the way they want them. Know anybody like that? I might have got two sometimes. But basically, I think the problem is that control freaks also don't have respect for other people's boundaries. They don't let people have their own feelings or their own opinions. They don't give people the freedom to say no to them. They feel that if people care about them, they'll do things the way they want them to. And they can be very manipulative and dishonest as a way of getting you to do what they want you to do. Yes?
In our mission, I've found that the control, people that really struggle with that, it really comes out in the kitchen. More than any other job, that's the job that it comes out in.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
But that's the best learning. That's actually one of the best places then to work through that.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh, that's where I see that it comes out.
That's a good point. Put all the control freaks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You'll never get a meal hour. But anyway, I think one of the things that is good to mention, though, and that is I've come to the conclusion that I would never, ever, ever let one program person supervise another. Unless this person is drawing a paycheck from your mission, they should never have authority.
As you talk about the whole concept of ownership and all that, ownership also involves some empowering.
Yes.
Of the fellows or men or women that we're working with on this. Does that play a part in this control thing?
Oh, that's a good point. Yes. How can you give ownership to people without turning it over to them 100%?
Uh-huh, right.
Well, let me tell you, here's my opinion. If you can create a written contract with them, like we talked about before, that's what they own. See, it's their program that they own. That the things that I need to do to get better, to see my life get on the right track, that's what I own. I don't own this building or this staff or everybody else. But part of that, though, and I think that's a really good point that we want to make, is that part of that ownership is this. This place will only do for you what you need if you're willing to be one of the people who makes it what it's supposed to be. Does that make sense? In other words, you're responsible for maintaining the healing environment as well as the staff people. As a program person, if someone is using, it's in my best interest to turn them in. Even though I might like this person, even though I might feel like I want their approval and acceptance and friendship, I learn because my sobriety is dependent upon you getting this right, that I want to make sure that you're confronted with your stuff properly. But I'm not going to be part of the game playing that so oftentimes happen. Do you ever see conspiracies in your programs where these things are going on behind the scenes and everybody, all the people in the program know it, but the staff doesn't? Well, guess what? That's the number one tip-off that they don't have ownership. Because what's happening is they, again, have brought the street in. It's not the kingdom. Those aren't kingdom rules. That's street rules. That's what we see in the joint, not in the kingdom of God. And so, but the goal, and it can happen, is that people who are not going to live by kingdom rules will be very uncomfortable if this building is full of people who are living by kingdom rules. People who are committed to sobriety can put such a pressure on those who aren't sincere that either they break and change their hearts or they leave. I think basically, you know your program is working the way it needs to when you hardly ever dismiss anybody, but they leave on their own. Yes, did you have and so really, and even talking about rules, we could talk about this before, but my conviction is the fewer rules, the better. And why you have rules is setting boundaries. And it's not because you like to tell people what to do, but that you realize that there are just a few things that we need to do together to make this healing environment comfortable and manageable for all of us. And although we sometimes have to deal with consequences, hopefully people who are committed to recovery realize that these few rules are essential and can live within them. And ultimately, we talked about using, but really, besides using, I only believe there's only one other reason to dismiss anybody. You know what that is? No, resistance. Well, stealing is a sign of resistance, in my opinion. No, resistance to the process. A resistance to recovery. And see, when people start doing stuff like stealing or like staying out too late, like everything else, do we dismiss them because they don't abide by our rules? No, we dismiss them because by their behavior, they've shown us they don't want what we have. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Then you're a rule breaker, get out of here. It's like I sit down with them and say this very simply. You said when you came into the program, you agreed to these things, this contract that we have. By your behavior, you've shown us you really don't want this. And that's resistance. And that's the only reason to dismiss anybody.
Yes, what tools can we use for working with community codependency? Within our native communities, especially, and we're in the fourth and fifth generation of what I refer to as wholesale welfare,
uh-huh. This
is a breeding ground for codependency.
Absolutely. How do you deal with dependency in your community?
Yeah.
I think probably one person at a time. I don't know if there's any way you can change a community, but at least help and educate the people and not be a part of it yourself. What was your question back there? Uh-huh.
And we dismiss them for 30 days. Do you recommend that we allow them to go back to the emergency temporary building, or they have to completely leave the facility?
Okay. The zero tolerance policy and dismissing people under use. Yeah, I think it's okay to go back to the transient dormitory or the emergency thing. But I should say that there should be a real big difference between the transient facility and the program. Now there's an issue, and I talked about this whole thing of the therapeutic environment and the other resource, but I believe that one of the most important things we could do is segregate people who are in your program from those who are not. And now I've heard of missions where people are sleeping together all in the same dormitory. That's awful. There should be a real incentive to go to the program because the facilities are nicer, that there's only, maybe I get a private room or a couple people sharing a room and not a big dormitory, that I get more privileges, that I get to eat first. You know what I'm saying? That there are ways, and there ought to be ways to set up your facility so that there's actually, the program is more appealing in just the atmosphere, the physical structure, and that there's, I mean, I'm really an advocate for clutter-free buildings. You know, because if we're trying to teach people to clean up their lives, and yet they're living in clutter, we're sending a different contradictory message. And so hopefully and I believe honestly that the less institutional we can make our programs, the better results we're going to have. So if we have colors, and we have draperies, and we have paintings, and we have carpeting, you know, sometimes, and of course, the transient things, we've got to have brick, concrete walls and concrete floors and things that are easy to clean and et cetera. But when you get to the program, if we're trying to create this family environment, I think we want to do all that we can to make it homey. And there are some missions that I've seen that are very creative about this. That if there are men's programs with men's staff, many of them actually have a woman consultant. Because women have a better knack for making a home than men do. And I've seen it here at the City Union Mission where Shirley became the house mom of the men's program. And immediately, the thing went from a very institutional look to something much more of a home and family look. And people's attitudes changed. And because, you know, when the place is institutionalized, there's a little bit of alienation and detachment and unsettledness about it, whereas a more home-like atmosphere creates a better environment. And I would even look at different colors. You know, there have been a lot of psychological studies that talk about the colors you paint your walls and carpet and furniture. And there are certain things like that that can make an environment that's much more pleasing and comfortable. And so we, you know, it's important that what if we have such a place, when people are approached about participating in the program, we show it to them, where they can see it's much more cushy, enjoyable, comfortable. We want to have that. We want to make, not just for the hypothetical reasons that they would go on a program, but also the creature comfort reasons, if you know what I'm saying. Yes?
But what if they come back to you? Say you have this, where your shelter looks like a home, it's nice, and you have the carpet, the drapes and things. But then they come around and say, you want it, it looks like a home, but you don't let us act like it's a home.
Well, that's a good question. It looks like a home, but you don't let us act like it's a home.
Yeah.
Then I could say, well, yeah, but this is not your family of origin. This is a new family.
Okay. I needed that answer.
Yeah, because a lot of people, when they say home, I think it can conjure up a very dysfunctional place. Yeah.
We had a large donation of stuffed animals come in.
Huh.
And I was amazed how quickly they disappeared, and it didn't go to the families and the kids. I mean, they did, but a lot of the guys on the program had stuffed animals.
You meant took the stuffed animals,
yeah.
That's good. Well, we need to break, and we'll be coming to another session. This is going to, we'll build upon some of the things that we shared. Thanks for this session. I'll see you in a little while.